You're listening to Greater LA, KCRW show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiatakis. 126,000 gallons. So far, that's officially the amount of crude oil that has spilled into the Pacific Ocean off the coast of Huntington Beach in Orange County. A huge oil slick has formed, and clumps of oil and tar are already coating the nearby coastline. Here's the mayor of Huntington Beach, Kim Carr.
To see the environmental impact on our shore, to me, it's absolutely devastating. And we're going to do everything that we can to clean that up quickly and make sure that the responsible parties do their part as well.
The leak is reportedly coming from a 17.5-mile broken pipeline that connects an offshore crude oil processing platform to a refinery at the Port of Long Beach. A company called Beta Operating owns the platforms. It's a subsidiary of Amplify Energy, which is based in Houston. Gustavo Arellano is a columnist to the LA Times. He's here every week with KCRW's Orange County Line. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
We're also joined by Sean Anderson, a professor of environmental science and resource management over at CSU Channel Islands. Sean, welcome to you.
Thanks, you guys.
Gustavo, I'm going to start with you. Give us a quick TikTok of what happened. I mean, at least what we know right now. People in Huntington Beach first started smelling the oil. Is that what we're hearing? Friday?
Yeah, the people have been saying Friday night, Saturday morning, but there was smell. There was something up in the air that wasn't the usual, you know, the usual smells that you get from the Orange County coastline. By Saturday afternoon, people knew, okay, there is a spill. Surfers, my colleague Joe Mozingo was talking about how on Saturday morning he went out to surf, and he was noticing something up to the point where dolphins were just swimming like crazy. And at first he thought, oh, it's like nature, it's cool. But now he's wondering if it was something a little bit more ominous than that. And it was happening at a time where there was over 1 million people in Huntington Beach for the annual air show where you have the Blue Angels and all other jets going across. So it was a great Saturday for everyone. Then Sunday morning, that's when the extent of the damage was really starting to take place.
And they postponed or canceled the rest of the air show, right, because of that.
Oh, yeah. You had people from all over the West coming in because, you know, it's a family-friendly event. It hadn't happened last year because of the coronavirus pandemic. And the beaches were closed. Huntington Beach officials closed the beach. By Sunday evening, you had the city of Laguna Beach also closing down their beaches. Newport Beach didn't officially close their beaches, but they told everyone, you probably better not be going in the beach right now for a couple of days, if not weeks, until we figure out where this oil's going.
Yeah, I mean, we're hearing reports that it's certainly inching toward Newport, Crystal Cove State Park, places like that. You mentioned Huntington Beach. Gustavo, what are people on the ground seeing along the coastline? I mean, is there a lot of oil drifting onto shore? We've seen pictures, and that's what it looks like.
It's getting there. I mean, some places are going to get it harder than others. The authorities, Coast Guard, cities, they're doing everything possible with their technology to keep as much of the oil in the ocean, eventually capture it, but it's going to seep through. So you're already seeing on the local news, you're seeing fish dead. I saw a pelican coated in black. Rescue workers had to get it with a net. And then in the next couple of days, we'll see the full toll, especially on animals.
So, Sean, you've studied responses to oil spills. When there's this kind of leak, what's the first course of action? I mean, the company had to find the leak, right, and stop
it
somehow. Yeah. This is that 17.5-mile pipeline. How hard is it to do when you're talking about that long of a pipeline that's so deep in the ocean?
Well, it's not that hard to shut off the actual oil flow. The issue is when we have a tube like this, a container, if there is a breach in it and you turn off the ends, there's still a volume that's going to leak out. So it sounds like they've staunched the major flow. But today, right now, as we're speaking, there's divers down looking to see if make sure that was everything. So they've reported that they've stopped the majority of the flow, but there's still potentially other stuff going on. So the technical term for this is a blowout. So a spill, this is my nerdy professor side of me talking, but a spill is when we have a barrel of oil, let's say, and rip it open. And we know that that's what happened. With a blowout, which is something more like the Deepwater Horizon, the oil is potentially still going. And so when we have these numbers about, you know, 120,000 or what have you, that's the same number people have been quoting for the last 2 days. So it's unclear the actual amount that's been released. But the first thing is to just stop it. You know, let's turn off the valve. Let's shut stuff in. The next thing is the stuff that has been released. We want to deal with it. And what's happening with this oil spill seems to be very similar to what happened with the 2015 Refugio spill, which is we typically think of something, a wildfire, a disaster, and the problem thing starts, and then the worst is right next to the source, and then it's a little bit less farther away. What's happened with the 2015 spill and this spill, the oil has gone offshore, and it's sort of chilling in different baskets, and then little parts of that oil are spinning off little gyres, and they're dolloping into the coast here and there. So yeah. it's some areas are getting hit, other areas are not getting hit, and it's leading the public to be skeptical, right? So some people, this happens and they say, oh my God, it's way worse than they said in the news, or they say it's nothing like it was in the news. And so it leads to confusion amongst a lot of the public sometimes.
Yeah, Refugio was up in Santa Barbara County, right? That was in 2015, about 6 years ago.
Yes, Refugio was in, like when you're on the 101 and you're going north, you're in Santa Barbara, and then just the 101 heads inland, just about there where the 101 heads inland. So about halfway up the Santa Barbara County coastline.
Let's hear from Mayor Kim Carr of Huntington Beach again about the mitigation efforts that's going on there along the shore.
Our local response efforts have been focused on two major priorities. First, protecting the health and safety of our residents and visitors. And second, preventing an ecological disaster by mitigating the impacts of the oil on our precious wetlands and wildlife.
All right, so let's talk about that, Sean. What does that look like on the ground, trying to mitigate, trying to make it better, to stop it from spreading so far?
So first and foremost, it's going to be containment. So we want to try to encircle the oil that's mostly floating, and we want to keep it relatively at bay. This was aided by the relatively mild winds yesterday. And so that's going to be floating booms out in sea. We have 14 different vessels currently deployed, deploying booms. It also means in areas of particular concern, and she mentioned the wetlands, we want to seal off the mouth essentially with floating material so that the oil can't get in. But in general, this is going to arrive on our sandy beaches and in areas that accumulate. So things like harbors, things like those inlets to our estuaries.
Gustavo, what do we know about the owner of the platforms, Amplify, which is based in Texas? I mean, it emerged from bankruptcy just a few years ago, right?
Oh, yeah. Long record of federal noncompliance incidents and violations. They took over this platform over in Huntington Beach, or off the coast of Huntington Beach, some years back. And records, my colleagues at the LA Times, they showed that they were planning to do new drilling near the site of the leak in the final 3 months of this year, according to their own records. We'll see if that's going to happen, though. If I'm sure the state's going to have a big problem with their plans.
Sean, what about accountability? I mean, who's going to end up paying for this cleanup? What happened at Refugio?
Yeah, you'll pay for it is the short answer. We'll pay for it. So the story with Refugio, which was similar in the sense, originally when these oil extraction infrastructure devices went in, they were a big company. It was a Chevron, it was a Unocal, et cetera. Over the years, over the last 40-ish years, 40, 50 years, these structures have been sold off. And so we have secondary, tertiary companies owning this infrastructure. And as Gustavo was mentioning, there's a lot of maintenance that has to happen. Steel in the ocean corrodes and the like. And so this is difficult to do for a well-financed company, but as we have these smaller and smaller companies, it's even harder, particularly ones that are in bankruptcy. In the case of the Plains All American, which was the pipeline that leaked in the 2015 spill, it was a lack of maintenance. It was essentially the tube carrying the oil was corroded and paper thin. In this case, we don't know yet. So I don't want to place any blame here until we know the facts, but it seems likely that deferred maintenance, things of that nature came into play. What used to happen during oil spills, we had new policies, we had new approaches. What came out of the 89 Exxon spill is a thing called OPA 90, the Oil Spill Protection Act of 1990. That changed the game. It used to be some economists calculated how much money this business lost or how much money an otter is worth. And they said, oh, we killed 20 otters. Well, 20 otters times $500 equals that's what we have to pay. Now, the so-called responsible party, which is the oil company here, now what they have to do is they have to recover the resource. So if we determine that we killed 1,000 seabirds, it doesn't matter how much it costs. They have to make 1,000 seabirds more. However, if this company goes bankrupt or doesn't have the resources, that's where you and I step in as the taxpayers and as the regulators.
Gustavo, back in 1969, infamously, 3 million gallons of crude oil leaked from an offshore drilling site off the coast of Santa Barbara. That was a calamitous event, huge disaster, launched the environmental political movement against offshore drilling. But there are still nearly two dozen oil and gas drilling platforms in federal waters off the coast of California. You can see them sometimes when you're headed up the 101 and the 1. Is the state powerless to do anything about these operations?
Oh, no. Not especially when it's run by a supermajority of Democrats. So over the years, but this is interesting. It's been a bipartisan effort by both Republican and Democratic governors in California to sort of check that. So in state waters, the oil platforms, they have not been allowed since 1969. In federal waters, that's different. And of course, under the Obama administration, there were even more regulations because that's when the deep water disaster happened as well. But under the Trump administration, they started to try to at least figure out how can we get around this this precedent that we've had of previous administrations not allowing these things to happen. So California, with its attorney generals over the years, they're always going to try to sue, not just the state, but also counties and cities. It's really sacrosanct at this point in California history that oil drilling on the coast, it's a thing of the past. And those things that are still around, they're relics, and they're just waiting for the days for those things to finally tap out, and then we move on from that chapter in history. But sadly, events like what happened over the weekend in Huntington Beach, they're a reminder that, okay, we need oil, but what's more important, oil that comes from the ocean or the carekeeping of our pristine shore, which in many people say is probably one of the most valuable resources that California has.
Well, 900 plus miles of shoreline up and down the state. Sean, you're an academic. You study public perceptions in addition to the environmental and economic impacts of these spills. I mean, do spills like this one tend to shift opinions on offshore
Absolutely.
Drilling?
And we've seen that. So we've been monitoring public opinion since 2007. Firstly, nobody wants to expand oil drilling. So there's no significant effect of that. It's basically zero. What does happen, though, when we have these oil spills is the people that want to end it or radically curtail what's going on definitely increases. So for what we saw in the 2015 spill is we looked at 33 different beaches up and down the coast, Santa Barbara, LA, et cetera. What we found was when the oil spill happened, people came to the beach with the same frequency. They drove the same distances to get to the beach. However, when they got to oil beaches, they said, screw this, and they left. And so that effect pretty much disappeared after about 2 months or so. So it's a relatively short lot. We have these long-term public perception impacts and also these short-term impacts. But right now, because of COVID-19, a lot of these businesses, small mom and pop businesses, are holding on, by their fingernails. And the worry is that if people, don't come, don't pay for parking, don't get their beers, don't get lunch, et cetera, don't get a hotel room, that might be enough to really, drive some of these businesses out. So it's another example of this insult on top of insult on top of insult. Yeah. And that's a big problem.
Yeah. Exacerbating what's already been, pretty, pretty bad times for business owners, especially along the coast. Sean Anderson, Professor of Environmental Science and Resource Management over at CSU Channel Islands. Gustavo Arellano, columnist for the LA Times. Thanks to you both.
Thanks, you guys.
Gracias.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Moving on now with Greater LA on KCRW, I'm Steve Chiotakis. We're at a grand opening event in Anaheim, filled with a who's who of Orange County. Local politicians, Disney park executives, realtors, developers.
Once you RSVP and check in, please make your way over to the courtyard. We have lots of yummy treats for you, coffee, iced coffee.
With all the backslapping and business casual attire, it has the feel of a Chamber of Commerce event, the kind of soiree that would be thrown for the opening of a new business park or a shopping mall. But this place was once a notorious Anaheim eyesore, a place where few people here today would ever have gone. It was a rundown Econo Lodge motel that's now been turned into a completely renovated 69-unit permanent housing project for the homeless. It's the first such motel-to-homeless housing conversion in Anaheim's history, and the city's mayor, Harry Sidhu, says he's elated.
It improves the neighborhood, number one. That we are taking a sleazy motel and converting a rundown into a most beautiful project. Second thing it represents, that we can actually take the people off the street that who are homeless and put them into a permanent housing.
In California right now, there's an intense focus on turning old motels and other aging business properties into housing for the homeless, and doing it faster and cheaper than in the past. It's because of a state program called HomeKey that's become the centerpiece of California's efforts to fight homelessness. And many California cities, such as Anaheim, that are filled with aging motels, hope HomeKey can also give dangerous and decaying properties new life and help improve neighborhoods. KCRW has teamed up with KQED's Saul Gonzalez of the California Report for a series of stories to learn more about HomeKey and its potential. And Saul picks the story up from here.
Planning and financing for this Anaheim motel, now called Buena Esperanza, actually started well before HomeKey existed, and it isn't part of the program. But it is a good example of what the higher cost, slower approach to homeless housing can buy. The renovations here are impressive. The rooms look brand new, and there are amenities, like a community lounge with a big screen TV and comfortable couches, counseling rooms with soothing decor, and a big patio area with grills for outdoor dining. But creating this wasn't fast and it wasn't cheap. Michael Massey is the chief housing officer for Jamboree, the Orange County nonprofit housing developer behind this project.
A lot of sweat and cooperation, but and then in dollar terms, it's about $25 million project.
And how long did it take you to do this?
This was not atypical in that it took us about 3 years, 3 to 4 years from concept to today.
So, 3+ years and $25 million to create 69 homeless housing units here. But when it comes to HomeKey projects, the state wants the timelines to be much shorter and the dollar amount spent per unit lower. HomeKey is really new. Motivated by the pandemic, last year the state began distributing hundreds of millions of dollars in federal and state funds to cities and counties. In partnership with local nonprofit developers, that money is being used to buy up and refurbish old business properties, especially motels, and turn them into long-term supportive homeless housing for 6,000 people. And Michael Massey knows about that because his company got $26 million in HomeKey funds to purchase and renovate two dilapidated motels in the community of Stanton, right next door to Anaheim.
All right, coming into unit. Is this the, kind of the standard room here?
Yeah, this is very typical of the units here at the Stanton Inn & Suites. We have sizable units that are really livable.
This 70-room motel conversion is happening at lightning speed compared to what we saw in Anaheim.
So HomeKey was announced in September of 2020. We closed on this project in November of 2020.
So 2 months instead of exactly, 3.5 years.
Exactly. We had our rehab completed just a couple of weeks ago. So that's 7-8 months, basically, of rehab. Now we're moving into our permanent financing phase, and we will close our financing on the permanent portion of this in February of next year. So that's about a year and a half from zero to go for us, which is extraordinarily short. That's a pretty close to a record for us.
And Massey's company and its partner, Orange County, are trying to keep renovation costs down to meet HomeKey goals.
We're stewards of public funding, and so we have to make sure that we're using that wisely and efficiently and in the smartest way that we know how, because we're going to operate these as permanent supportive housing for a very long time.
So, at least for now, the rooms are decent and the grounds clean, but it doesn't have all the bells and whistles of the Anaheim property. The rooms here still have a bit of that musty old motel aroma, and there's no shiny community room or outdoor grills, just a small pool with no water in it.
We had a little over $1 million to spend on these 70 units to get them kind of to the state where we can have somebody living here. We've spent traditionally somewhere between $75,000 and $125,000 per unit on the rehab.
$75,000 to $125,000 on the rehab only.
Correct.
So can you put those numbers together, and are we looking at a per unit cost?
So I think a good estimate when we rule of thumb this, we're probably talking about $325,000, $350,000 a unit all in.
Now, that may sound pricey, but it's still below the per unit cost of the homeless project in Anaheim and way below building homeless housing from scratch in places like L.A., where costs have been well over $500,000 per unit on some projects.
Look, there's a reason that building affordable housing is expensive. I can name six or eight off the top of my head.
Hard costs, soft costs.
The sustainability, no ongoing cash flow to make sure that they're maintained appropriately, so we have to invest up front. Plus the general resistance to building anything, much less building housing, much less building affordable housing, much less building permanent supportive housing. So what we do isn't cheap, but we live in California, and building anything in California is not cheap.
Looking ahead, the state wants to distribute more than $2.5 billion more in home key funds. That's supposed to be enough to house another 14,000 people, up from 6,000 now. Homeless housing developers are already looking for more properties. And Anaheim and neighboring communities with lots of homeless people and lots of old motels think it might be a way to both get people off the streets and find a better use for old properties. I talked about that with Anaheim's mayor, Harry Sidhu.
So you don't mind these properties being turned into long-term housing? You think that's a great opportunity?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I mean, we have a lot of homeless people. You know, they are in shelters right now. We need to transition them into a permanent housing somehow. And I'm going to do as many as possible if the funding is available to get these people off the street and clean the neighborhood.
And the mayor is especially concerned about one street.
You look at Beach Boulevard, especially Beach Boulevard, that we'll be able to use all of those motels if we get all the funding that is available.
Beach Boulevard is an 8-lane-wide monster of a thoroughfare, packed full of decaying 1950s and 60s-era motels with names like the Jade Palace, the Riviera, and the Americana. A half century ago, these businesses were sleek symbols of America's love affair with the open road, where families would stay while visiting Disneyland and Knott's Berry Farm. But what are the motels like today? Well, let's have Marletta tell us.
What are they all about? What should people know?
Honestly, they are about sex, drugs, and violence. That sums that up in three words. Sex, drugs, and violence. There's a lot of prostitution, there's a lot of drugs, and there's a lot of violence going on all at the same time. Behind the walls of these hotels up and down Beach Boulevard.
I met Marletta, who doesn't want her last name used because she's embarrassed about her living situation, in a parking lot along Beach Boulevard. She's homeless herself, and when she has the money, will often check herself into one of the Beach Boulevard motels. But she says the stays are never restful.
There's been times where I thought I was really going to die. So it's scary out here.
And the motels kind of create this kind of environment
where... They're 10 times worse. They are the eye of it. You know what I mean? That's where it begins.
Michael Massey's development company, Jamboree, is now evaluating 10 more potential home key sites, including around Beach Boulevard. And he says other cities are starting to realize the potential of home key to both house the homeless and improve neighborhood life.
We're getting phone calls, and cities are calling us and asking us, how did you do that? How did you make that happen? We have these motels as well. We see this as a win-win situation. Cities get that now. They're understanding that. Yes, we think this is an opportunity to really move the needle at a time when it's desperately needed.
As she tries to survive on the streets, Marletta offers this advice to officials managing Home Key. Move fast because the need is great, and stick to ambitious plans.
I mean, I know it's probably more complicated than that, but it's hard out here. You know, it's a lot of homeless people. And I think these streets, especially around here, because it's really nasty and dirty, would be a little more you know, calmer, cleaner. And I won't be scared when I'm walking up and down Beach Boulevard. I got like two knives on me. You know what I mean? Like, they need to clean it up. And the first thing they need to do is give people somewhere to live.
For Greater LA and the California Report, I'm Saul Gonzalez.
All the time we have for today. Tomorrow in the South Bay, Bruce's Beach goes back to its African-American owners who were chased away decades ago. But is that the end of the story? How will the transfer of ownership work? And what will it mean for the future? And a plan to shift LA council districts has all kinds of political repercussions. We're going to talk about it tomorrow on the next episode of Greater LA. We're online, by the way, at kcrw.com/GLA. Subscribe to the podcast. Get episodes wherever you get your podcasts. Tell us how you're feeling and what you want to hear about on Greater LA. kcrw.com/GLA. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Lorenzo Ponce de Leon, Amy Ta, Christine Camito, Holly Adams, and Christian Bordahl all help make the show happen. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for your ears and time tonight. Have yourself a great night.